Okay, we're ready for the next talk. If you'd all take your seats, there is going to be a quiz. When I spoke with Rainer yesterday and informed him that I was going to be moderating the session, he said he needed no introduction. So, for those of you who may not be familiar with Dr. Lotz, he's had a continuing endeavor for more than 40 years, and he's to contribute numerous reference sources, discographies, research, graphics, photos, reissues, heck, just plain issues, stuff that hasn't been out before. Generally having to do with recordings in Europe, often in Germany in particular. Included in this is a massive multi-volume German National Discography, which has just published a new volume on Judaica. In recognition of his considerable accomplishments, Dr. Lotz has been the recipient of an ARSC Lifetime Achievement Award in 1998. In other words, he's an eminent economist, which I found out from your website, we're correct, an eminent discographer, an eminent researcher, and with friends like these, who needs eminence? Today, Dr. Lotz's talk relates to his continuing study of performers of African descent in Europe and their recordings.
Thank you and good afternoon. I hope you are still awake and can stand another half hour or so of strange sounds and German English. Somewhat laughing. Since I last addressed you on the topic of cross-cultural links between Germans and African Americans, I have been able to, quote unquote, persuade Richard Weitzer of Bear Family Record to take up a completely idiotic project of mine, and that is the reissue of all the sounds ever made by people of African descent in Europe. And since that would be a project that for which I should be locked up, I have a time frame, and I said to him, let's just confine ourselves to recordings made during the acoustic era, before microphones. And he said, yes, okay. And at that time, he didn't know that we were speaking about some 2,000 sound documents, which, if they are issued on CDs, would be about 30 CDs or something like that. I also proposed to him to add DVDs of all films made by black people, both sound films, which were also made in the acoustic era, and silent films. And for the good luck of Richard Weitzer of Bear Family, this proved to be too expensive. And yes, the owners of films charge prices which are beyond the capabilities of others than TV stations and commercial filmmakers. And others maybe often films, but apart from home movies, nobody knows who the real owners are, and those who own the films don't dare to hand them over to us because some rightful owner might turn up, after all, and charge the prices the others ask. So couldn't do that project on my own, and I asked several friends of mine to join me. And let me see how I can. Yeah, one of them is Jeffrey Green, an eminent historian from England, from the United Kingdom. And the other one is Howard Rye, whom you may know as the editor of the Revised Blues and Gospel Record, a huge discography. And Jeffrey Green has done a lot of research and published books about blacks in Britain. The types of performances can roughly be divided into two categories, those by Africans and those by African Americans from the United States mainly. I understand that most of you are mainly interested in African American recordings, but when I started on this presentation, I understood that our host would be the Ethnomusicology Archive here in California, and unfortunately, there is a parallel sessions where all the ethnomusicologists are, and I'm now talking to you non-ethnomusicologists. So I have selected some five examples of strange, even bizarre recordings by Africans, and after that, if we have the time, we will turn to recordings made by African Americans. Here is Jeffrey Green again. Now, first, let's start with the Pygmies. James Harrison was an Oxford-educated world traveler, big game hunter, and officer in a socially elitist volunteer cavalry regiment in Britain, who saw no war service in 20 years, but still rose to the rank of major, and he spent part of his money hunting trophies in the Congo forest and in search of the elusive okapi, which he never found, but he made photographs of pygmies. And his photographs created interest in Britain. He seems to have entered a contract with theater owners to bring Congo pygmies to Britain, and he did. On a return visit in 1905, Harrison recruited six pygmies and brought them to London. Their interpreter was a German-born Londoner, William Hoffman. From the late 1880s, he had been employed as valet by the explorer Stanley in the Congo. Having been dismissed and reemployed and dismissed and reemployed again and again for stealing, lying, cheating, and generally being dirty, we can only speculate what special relationship there existed between Stanley and this man Hoffman, and I won't publish this here and speak about it in public. So, quote, that weird band of little people from a strange land, as they were called, appeared on stage. They danced and sang. They also visited the Foreign Office and Parliament and attended a garden party at Queen Victoria's, Buckingham Palace. The six pygmies seem to have made the first commercial recordings in Europe by Africans. Made in London, pressed in Germany, and released in early 1906, the five gramophone company discs have escaped the attention of anthropologists. The labels identify them as pygmy, most likely they were Akka or Assawa people. The record is labeled Oriental Talking. The record was categorized as Oriental Talking. The English voice introduces the group, stating the date and the place in a King's English sort of language, and then this is immediately followed by the strange sounds of Chief Bokani. Could we have the first track, please?
Native folk song by Chief Bokani, Chief of the Pygmies from Central Africa, August 25th, 1905, London.
Right, so next is the book cover of a work written by Arnold Holz. Arnold Holz was a German entrepreneur and traveler with an office in Addis Ababa. He had been received by Emperor Menelik a number of times. Around 1905, he proposed to the German Foreign Office. They presented Ethiopia's emperor with a truck-size motor car in order to strengthen relations. The vehicle was about 20 feet long, had a maximum speed of 8 miles per hour. But the mountainous terrain, there were no roads at that time, of course, defeated the vehicle, which was too heavy and the engine too weak. It took Holtz another 3 years to undertake a second attempt. And in early 1908, he reached Addis Ababa and the imperial residence at an altitude of some 8,000 feet in a 35-horsepower vehicle. However, his British competitors have been clever and had been there first. They beat him by 20 days. Now, this man, Holtz, he was a shrewd businessman, and he had one ace up his sleeve. The bodywork of his car was painted with the Ethiopian lions, and that earned Holtz the trust of the emperor, and he beat the British after all. So, Emperor Menelik now had a car, actually two cars, the German and the British, but no drivers, no chauffeurs. So Holtz, the clever businessman, took three Ethiopians that were selected by the Negus, by the emperor, and took them to Germany for training and further training and to be trained as mechanics. There in Berlin, one of the three Ethiopians, Tessema Eshete, recorded more than 50 titles for the Beka company. According to the family, and I have spoken to the grandson of this Ethiopian, he returned from Germany rich and famous, having recorded gramophone discs for an honorarium of the equivalent of $112,000. This amount was exorbitant, for no other recording artist of the period is known to have been paid similar sums. I'm sure Holtz, the shrewd businessman, was trying another way to impress the emperor. We don't know why and how, but he had something up. Now, surviving packing lists for those Beka records reveal that only one copy of each disc was sent to Ethiopia. And three crates were sent to one Deja Tafori in the city of Harar. And Deja Tafori is none other than Rasteferi Makonnen, who is or was the future king Haile Selassie, who took the world stage when Mussolini invaded his country in the 1930s. So Holtz had already put his bet on the future emperor, and he couldn't know at the time that he gained his throne through a coup d'etat, but that makes the difference between a poor and a good businessman. Now, our recording artist Tessema Eshete was the son of a professional court musician, and he must have learned text and melodies from him, from his father. Most are double entendre songs performed in the Amharic language, praising heroes and nobility, but he also knew a repertoire of religious songs, and Linoch Hameru is a prayer to Saint Mary performed in Ge'ez, which is the liturgical language of the Ethiopian Orthodox Church. That's an ancient Christian church, of course. Eshete accompanies himself on the masinko, that is a sort of a violin made out of a wooden soundbox covered by an animal skin, and the second voice heard on the recording we are now listening to is that of a companion, one of the two companions. Okay. No copy of the original Baker disc has ever been found. This is a later repressing on the Odeon label, and only one copy of those Odeon discs have been found, and they are at the National Archive in Addis Ababa, and had been transferred with pre-low-fidelity equipment on a musical cassette, and the record has since been broken, and it cannot be recorded any better than the example we just heard. Now, let's turn to another bizarre episode, and that is the German prisoners of war during the First World War. Prisoner of war camps were set up all over Germany. One camp about 25 miles south of Berlin was different from all others. It was specially built for Muslims. They received privileged treatment and had a mosque built for them, and this camp was therefore known as the Crescent Camp. Baron Max von Oppenheim, an archaeologist who spoke fluent Arabic, he was the German counterpart to Lawrence of Arabia, suggested that Muslims could be persuaded to turn against their colonial masters, France, Britain, and Russia. A newspaper, El Jihad, was distributed in the camp for that purpose, and in several languages, including Arabic. Now, other African prisoners were kept at two other separate camps. These three camps were of special interest for linguistic researchers and ethnologists due to the inmates having a rich diversity of cultures. Between 1915 and 1918, a so-called Royal Prussian Phonographic Commission collected a total of almost 3,000 recordings of prisoners of war, and in some 250 different languages, dialects, and traditional music. While the war lasted, these activities were kept secret. Among those who recorded was Albert Kujabo, who was not a Muslim, but a Catholic from the Belgian Congo. In spite of his missionary education and long absence from home, the young man, who was 24 years of age in 1917, was able to demonstrate that in Africa, the same message content can be conveyed by speech, like you and me, but also by drumming and also by whistling. The archives recording sheets state that he does not play any native instruments in the camp. However, Kujabo clearly plays different drums on the recordings and can be seen on a photograph, this photograph, using a slit drum made of a hollow tree trunk. Perhaps the trunk was brought from the Ethnographic Museum in Berlin. Let's hear an excerpt of a recording on which he demonstrates the words. We are talking about 1917, it is war, which it was, and he speaks into the horn by drumming, by spoken word, and by whistling. And this was the Kibera language spoken at his home in the then Belgian Congo. Now, we are still in Africa, and now we turn to Saul Plunkey. Saul Plunkey is the gentleman to the far left in the upper row. He was born in South Africa in 1876. From the mining town of Kimberley, he fought for political recognition of blacks and opposed the eventual territorial separation of blacks from the country's white population, later known as apartheid. Plunkey was alert to black ambitions in the United States by correspondence and reading the United States black press. In 1912, he co-founded the South African Native National Congress, later named the African National Congress, ANC, and he became the ANC's first secretary. In 1914, he was a member of a delegation to Britain to appeal for British government help against South African government policies. He returned to London in 1918 and again in 1923. In London, Plunkey appeared on stage as a spare carrying African in order to gather funds for his ticket home. Before his return, he had recorded several titles for the Zonophone Company in London in Setswana, Zulu, and Xhosa. One title is of particular interest, an innocent-looking Hlubi folk song, Across the Tugela. Not announced on the label and unknown, of course, to the management of the British record company, Plunkey switches from the folk song to a hymn, Nkosi Sin' Africa, God Bless Africa. The hymn was composed in 1897. It had spread beyond South Africa and was adopted at political meetings of Africans as a symbol of independence and resistance to apartheid, which is why it had been sung to open and close the first Congress meeting of the ANC in 1912. Plunkey was the first to record Nkosi Sikeli Africa in Europe. His tune became the national hymn of South Africa. We now play a short excerpt of the start, of the beginning of the recording, and then we will immediately follow that with the next track, which is the middle of that tune, and you will see that he switches from this innocent folk song to this anti-apartheid resistance song.
Intiyo yami ayikho apha ikudelo tukela ndikhumbulise lokhokho bethu sesiyale kothukela amkela masitikeleli Afrika maluphaka luthondolayo iba imithandazo wethu
This must be the first example in the history of recorded sound of subversive political propaganda on gramophone records. Now, it seems to be inevitable and inescapable, a rule of nature, really, that the moment you publish, no matter how intensely you have researched, new information will turn up. We were about to finalize work on Black Europe when Patrick Feaster alerted me to the fact that the African traveler Count de Brazza visited the Paris Universal Exposition in 1889 with about, quote, 15 representatives of different African tribes whose voices were recorded and reproduced on the phonograph being exhibited there on Edison's behalf. A collection of these cylinders is supposed to be preserved at the National Museum of American History at Washington, D.C. With luck, the recordings of Africans have survived. If they are found, they would be the earliest surviving recordings made in Europe of persons of African ancestry, but too late for inclusion in our proposed box. And, I forgot to show you that. That is the entry in the Zonophone catalog, where no mention is made, of course, of that forbidden song which he recorded, Sol Plunkey. Now, who would have thought that after Tim Brooks published his monumental Lost Sounds, and we owe Tim a lot for that, evidence of more recordings might turn up in the United States by black people. Yet we know that a Georgia Jubilee Colored Concert Company recorded Edison cylinders in New York in 1899, and that evidence came up it's probably too small for you to read, but in an Australian newspaper where a public demonstration of phonograph records was made, and this particular cylinder was mentioned. And in the 1898 Christmas number of the Indianapolis Freeman, we read that one Jenny Jacobs came to New York in 1890 at age 15 and accepted a position as phonographer. In 1893, she was the World Fair correspondent of the Chicago Mail and returned to the metropolis at the close of the Columbian Exposition. Miss Jacobs again resumed in New York her phonographic position. So what do we make of that cryptic reference? The cylinders certainly have not been found to date. At any rate, in 1897, Jenny Jacobs graduated in law at New York University, but apparently did not devote her life to law, but became a vaudeville agent. In 1901, she arrived in Britain as manager of Bella Davis and her Piccaninnies. All Bella Davis recordings will be included in our box, and I think I played one excerpt at the New Orleans conference to you. A few months before Bella Davis, however, another African-American arrived in Britain, and that was Seth Weeks. He too recorded for Berlina. Seth Weeks had started with a violin, but soon abandoned that in favor of the guitar and eventually the mandolin. After playing and practicing for some 15 years, he conducted a mandolin and guitar orchestra in Tacoma, Washington. His international reputation as America's greatest mandolin virtuoso was such that a few days after his arrival in Britain, and even before a scheduled performance at the Kamaya Festival of the Banjo, Mandolin, and Guitar, he made Berlina discs and Edison phonograph cylinders in London in 1900. Weeks can be credited with writing the first known American mandolin concerto in 1900. His published works include original mandolin compositions, mandolin arrangements, other instrumental music, and vocal music. Most of his vast recorded output, and it is really vast, notably the frail cylinders, has not been preserved. We have been unable to find any. His repertoire included Johannes Brahms and Franz von Suppé, but also at a Georgia camp meeting. This tune, although written towards the end of the century, is perhaps the best contemporary relic of minstrelsy. And despite of all his achievements, Weeks' achievement, his name is almost forgotten now, at least in the United States. Weeks' superb recording is syncopated in up-tempo, and he runs ahead of the pianist at time. Let's listen to a brief excerpt. The sides recorded by Weeks fill a gap in American recorded music, and that is also true of some of the other titles I'm going to play. Let us consider first the duettist Carlyle and Wellman, or Wellman and Carlyle. George Horace Carlyle was born in Minneapolis. He had studied piano in Chicago and Boston. On completion of his formal studies, he went to Vienna in Austria to take lessons from a pupil of composer pianist Franz Liszt. Carlyle started his profession or his professional career as a classical pianist, but he, as so many others, soon had to switch to popular music. He arrived in Britain in 1908. His partner from 1910 was pianist, singer, composer, music publisher, and orchestra leader Harry Wellman, who was born in Shelby, North Carolina. By 1906, Wellman was established in London as a composer. Working from his studio at Oxford Street, He wrote songs for popular music hall, that is, vaudeville artists. And he toured later on with his wife, and being an entertainer, he sometimes appeared as an Indian chief. That is Velman. In a report published in the British theatrical journal Entr'acte in 1906, Velman was called a born genius, yet he and his partner remain unknown in America. On record, they performed vocal duets written by the pair and accompanied by their own pianos. However, the following musical example is a non-vocal piano duet recorded in 1910, Chip Chip. This has been on a recent Kurt Nauck auction. It is a very rare record. I would have given my left arm to get it, but I already had it, fortunately. I wonder who is the lucky winner of that. Chip Chip has clear pianistics, the two pianists working well together. They must have been a superb music hall act with melodramatic arm movements and shifting the main playing from one to another. The record label says this was a two-step and a march. But certainly nobody could have marched to this very early examples of rousing, stomping, and dare I say, pre or proto stride piano. Once again, I'm running out of time, so I'm not playing the entire pieces and expose you to extracts only. The next unlikely pair is Charles Manny and Bob Roberts. Bob Roberts was born at Boston, Massachusetts in 1889. His earliest traced engagements are in 1907 with the Arlington Four, billed as singing and dancing messenger boys. In this quartet, he was linked with Charles Manny, who was born in New York City in 1890 and evidently of Jewish extraction. So Manny and Roberts, the African-American and the Jewish-American, went out in their own double act in 1912. The New York Clipper said, both boys are clever dancers executing many steps that brought them plenty of applause. The New York Clipper review of a Columbia concert the same year confirms that they performed in black and white face. The review added, "Certainly Not" was sung by the colored party in grotesque makeup, and they both finished with All Night Long. Here is the sheet music for All Night Long, but be prepared, this sheet music does not at all prepare you for the recorded performance. All Night Long was written in 1912 by Canada-born and Detroit-based Shelton Brooks. In 1915, the singers present this novelty song with an amount of scat singing. Legend has it that scat was first used by Louis Armstrong in his 1926 recording of the Heebie Jeebies, but it seems that scat singing has been known in vaudeville for decades. And even on record, we have 1911 recordings by Gene Green and later recordings, 1917, by Al Jolson. So, Manny and Roberts, however, can claim to be the first scat duetist on record, as you will now hear.
My sweetheart went away last night. I don't know what to do. And every time she goes away, I always feel so blue. All night long, all night long,
all night long.
She knows I love no one but her. that's why she is unkind. And every time she goes away, she's ever on my mind all night long. All night long.
Yes, all night long.
All night long. I am a dreaming, dreaming of my pride and joy. All night long, a song like these things I'm dreaming of my spy and pal. But when I hear that she retains, my poor heart will then grow strong.
So our next musicians are the Versatile Three, or the Versatile Four, who came to Europe first as members of James Rhee's Europe's, who had been members of James Rhee's Europe Clef Club in 1910. They came to Europe in September 1914, and as the war canceled their contracts, but they returned soon after in 1915. And in early February 1916, the Versatile Four recorded several popular African-American tunes, including Wilbur Sweatman's Down Home Rag, the most exciting and purely instrumental jazz-like performance by this group. But instead, I shall present their Circus Day in Dixie, as nothing comparable has ever been recorded in the United States by a group consisting of two banjos, piano, and drums. Circus Day in Dixie has mellow-sounding banjo, the band all sing, the snare drummer syncopates, he turns the woodblocks and cymbal, all behind the banjo lead, someone blows a whistle, and there are cries. The beat is excellent, it's a fine record to dance to, and how's that is shouted at the end. The group would have been an excellent sight on stage. Circus Day in Dixie is one of the most musically rewarding surviving documents of African American ragtime and string band music.
Thank you.
stress that all those recordings are raw transfers. They have not yet been mastered and worked upon, so the end result will be much better and clearer to listen to. Now, the last recording I'm going to present will be a duet of Hatch and Carpenter. The Red Devils was a jazz band composed of African Americans brought to Europe by Seth Weeks, the mandolin soloist whom I have mentioned before. And they recorded in London in 1920, but all titles were rejected and no tests have been found, no matter how hard we searched for them. The pianist of the Red Devils jazz band was Elliot Carpenter from Philadelphia, a baritone singer. After having toured in Egypt, Carpenter returned to the United States in 1923. By 1925, he had joined forces with Isaac Ike Hatch from New York. Hatch, a tenor, is said to have studied voice under Abby Mitchell and to have toured in vaudeville. In 1919, he was a regular banjo player in Wilbur Sweatman's band. In 1926, press release, it was claimed that Hatch could sing in Italian, French, and Jewish, and could speak the Jewish language fluently. Exactly 1 month after their arrival in England, Hatch and Carpenter made their first recordings for the Zonophone label in December 1925. They were to return to the studio many times. I'm selecting for you That's All There Is. It is a vocal duet, and Carpenter plays the piano and Hatch blows the kazoo. Presentation. In 1935, Carpenter returned to America. In 1942, he played the former drummer Dooley Wilson, who became world famous for not playing the piano in the 1942 movie Casablanca. That was actually played by none other than Elliot Carpenter. Hatch stayed in England, where he died later. So, in conclusion, it's extraordinary that so much of this apparently alien material found its way onto record in Europe. Extraordinary that it should include surely crucial oral documents of African-American musical styles. Styles they were not recorded in the United States, perhaps because they were already considered out of date. It is also extraordinary that some artists who were so popular in Europe went unrecorded, most notably Florence Mills. But few of the artists that appeared in Europe in the black cast shows, which perambulated the continent to appear before enthusiastic audiences, made it onto record either. We don't know why. Nor do we know why this period saw no recording of Latin American or French African diaspora music in Europe. But what the hell? We had better be grateful for what is already a varied legacy. Thank you very much indeed. We have no time, but I still take questions. Chris? It's a transfer problem. It will be straightened out on the release. Yeah. Mohsen? Sorry? Yes. Well, we work from the actual records, and therefore we have all the discographical details. I have it on my laptop. Yes? Well, it's one of the wonders of the internet that you can reach people all over the world within fractions of a second. And there is a coterie of friends and a network of researchers. And since we are in the business of record research and record collecting for the past half century, we know people and people know us. And still, of the 2,000 items that we have identified as potential candidates, about 20% have not been found as yet, mostly cylinder recordings, which have disappeared. And quite sure, certainly, the moment we publish, some of them will turn up. So, but I believe in publishing as is. If I wait for another year, things may turn up or may not turn up. And I'm glad that the Bear family took it upon them to publish the thing which can never sell. I don't know why they do it, but I'm glad they do.
How many CDs will it be?
We were thinking first of doing it on a USB stick. Then we were thinking about a DVD or two DVDs of MP3s. But now, finally, I have twisted the arm of Richard, and he will publish it on CDs, at least the African-American stuff.
How many?
Between 15 and 30. And, of course, a coffee table type book.
When is that projected?
Sorry, Vincent? At that time, the gramophone company switched from acoustic to electric and back. And so in that very session, we have both electric and acoustic session. Both acoustic and electric recordings. it was certainly improved, but it still didn't have the range of frequencies that you can achieve with the microphone. No, some titles were recorded with a microphone and some titles were recorded acoustically. And basically the cheap labels, Zonophones, were recorded acoustically, and the more prestigious Plum, His Master's Voice label, was recorded electrically early on.
Do you actually have all these discs?
I have most of the African American stuff, but the remainder we had to look the world over. It was very, very, very difficult to locate them all. And actually we paid a lot of money to the EMI archive for the right for transfer for those Zonophones and His Master's Voice that we could not find in any private collection. And happily, they have still most of them, not all of them. And they even had some Berliners, which nobody else has. And but about, say, 50% of what they had at one time is now gone, including legendary recording by Williams and Walker in London, which has never turned up, although I have spoken to Chris Ellis, an ardent record collector who has worked for EMI for many years, and he searched for it. He swears that he saw it once on a 7-inch Zonophone, but it has since gone, if it ever existed. I mean, we are all human, but he swears it's true. I just forwarded the text to the layouter, and hopefully when I return from the United States, I will have the first galley proofs, and that will take another month or two, and then the details for the book will be sent to China for printing, and the CDs will be printed somewhere in Europe, and the whole thing, the box, should be available by the end of the year. Late autumn, early winter.
We've done some books, but the CDs were also made in China. Very, very cheap.
Yeah, well, what Weitz is probably doing is print or burn the CDs on demand, because nobody can foresee how poorly or how well this box will sell. And another box I did for him 10 years ago was about Jewish music in Nazi Germany, which we thought would sell like hotcakes. And now, after 10 years, he has finally sold enough copies to recover his original expenditure, which means he's still running at a loss. But nowadays, with this new technology, you can have small print runs of 100 or 200 CDs, and that is more economical. So when the next 100 orders come in, they will burn another 100 copies of each CD. So otherwise, they would be in the storeroom and eating up money. And therefore, I think that the burning will actually take place in Europe, because of the logistics involved.
Would you be terribly opposed to the idea of keeping the ragtime and jazz type things separate and making some really, maybe just two CDs of the best of
that? I'm not involved in the business end of this box, and I have to leave it to Richard Weitze on how best to proceed. And what we probably will be doing is a separate set of CDs with African-American material, and publish the remainder, the ethnic recordings, almost 1,000 of them, on MP3 burned on DVD or an USB stick, because the demand for that is obviously limited to real ardent collectors and ethnologists and linguists, and not the broader public at large.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That concludes this session. Start saving up for those records now. And thank you, Kate.